Meta Practice V1. Part. The Wider Field, Chapter 14. A Brief History of Loving Kindness. Part. The Wider Field. Chapter 14. A Brief History of Loving Kindness. Most modern presentations of meta, including secular ones, including some of the most rigorous scientific ones, treat the practice as a kind of psychological technique. You sit, you generate a feeling, you direct it outward, your nervous system does something useful, and your life gets better. All of that is true. None of it is the deepest version of the truth. The deepest version is this. In its original form, this was a theistic practice. It was, more specifically, a practice for dwelling in the realm of the Creator God. It was the central instruction of the oldest layer of Indian religion that we have any record of, and it appeared again, in nearly identical form, at the heart of Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and the Sufi mystical tradition. Across thousands of years and dozens of cultures, the same realization keeps surfacing. Universal love is what divinity consists of, and dwelling in universal love is dwelling in the divine. The kingdom of heaven, in the famous phrase, is within you. You do not need to believe any of this to do the practice. The mechanism still works either way. But the practice is older, deeper, and more universal than its modern self-help repackaging would suggest, and it is worth knowing where it actually came from. The Vedic root. The word metta, in Pali, and its Sanskrit cognate maitri come from a much older root, mid, an ancient Indo-European word for love or friendship, which gives the noun mitra, friend, ally, one who keeps faith with you. The same root sits inside the English word amity and the Latin amicus. Mitra was also a Vedic deity. He was one of the Adityas, solar gods, sons of the goddess Aditi, and his domain was the bond of friendship, the keeping of oaths, and the cosmic order that holds beings to one another in trust. To live in Maitri, in the early Vedic sense, was to live in alignment with a god who was friendship. The practice was not invented as a self-improvement technique. It was understood as a form of devotion. The word Maitri appears across all four Vedas, the Rigveda, the Samaveda, the Yajurveda, and the Atharvaveda, and across their later Brahmana, Aranyaka, and Upanishadic layers. By 1000 BCE or earlier, the cultivation of universal friendliness was already a recognizable spiritual virtue with deep theistic roots. The Upanishadic turn, Brahmaloka and the divine realm. Sometime between 800 and 600 BCE, something important happened in Indian religious life. The center of gravity shifted from outward ritual, fire sacrifices, precise mantra chanting, toward inward virtue and direct realization. This shift is what we now call the Upanishadic turn. It produced some of the most philosophically ambitious texts in human history. One of those texts, the Chandogya Upanishad, contains in its 8th chapter, 8.15, what may be the oldest surviving formulation of metta as a complete spiritual path. It teaches the cultivation of friendliness and non-harm, ahimsa, toward all creatures, and it makes a striking claim. A person who lives this way will be reborn into Brahmaloka, the realm of the creator god Brahma, and not return. This is the original cosmological frame. The practice of universal love was understood, from the very beginning, as the way to enter and dwell in the realm of the divine creator. To love all beings was to live in God's neighborhood. To love them perfectly was to live in God's house. A second early Upanishad, the Maitri, Maitriya, Upanishad embedded in the Yajurveda and named for the practice, develops this further. Universal kindness is treated as the heart of the spiritual life. The Maitri Upanishad gives one of the earliest articulations of an idea that would echo through every later contemplative tradition: what one thinks, that one becomes. The mind that dwells in friendliness becomes a friendly mind. The mind that dwells in friendliness becomes, eventually, divine, because divinity is universal friendliness. Patanjali's fourfold formula. A few centuries later, the sage Patanjali compiled the Yoga Sutras, the foundational text of classical Indian yoga. Sutra 1.33 reads, Maitrikarimuditopek sukadukapuyuyavairi bhvanta sitta prasadanam. In plain English, by cultivating attitudes of friendliness toward the happy, compassion toward the suffering, sympathetic joy toward the virtuous, and equanimity toward the unrighteous, the mind becomes clear and undisturbed. This is the same fourfold formula that Buddhists would later call the Brahmaviharas, the abodes of Brahma, and that contemporary teachers call the Four Immeasurables. They are simply different aspects of metta meeting the actual variety of beings we encounter. Maitri, friendliness, is the foundation. Karu, compassion, is what it becomes when it meets suffering. Mudito, sympathetic joy, is what it becomes when it meets others' good fortune. Upek, equanimity, is what it becomes when it meets situations beyond our control. Patanjali was not inventing this, he was naming what was already taught. The Ramas, the Jains, and the Buddha. Around the same period, a parallel movement was forming on the Indian subcontinent, the Ramas, the Strivers. These were ascetic seekers who left ordinary household life to wander, meditate, and pursue liberation outside the temple priest establishment. The Buddha, born sometime around the 6th or 5th century BCE, was a Rama. So was Mahavira, the great teacher of Jainism. The two communities, Brahmanic and Rama, were not as opposed as later sectarian narratives suggest. In the earliest Vedic texts, Brahma and Rama were used together for the same kind of religious specialist. They shared meditative practices, including the cultivation of universal amity. Jainism, the most uncompromising of the Rama traditions to survive, built its entire ethical system around Ahis, non-harming, and Maitri, universal friendliness. The Jain emphasis on the inherent worth of every form of life, down to insects and microorganisms, gives the practice one of its strongest articulations anywhere, a metta extended without exception to every living being, no matter how small, no matter how alien. Even the Buddha used the theistic frame. A common modern misconception is that the Buddha taught a non-theistic, purely psychological version of this practice in opposition to the older Vedic tradition. The actual record tells a more interesting story. The Buddha never claimed the Brahmaviharas as his own invention. The very name Brahmavihara, abode of Brahma, is a Vedic frame. The practice was named for the goal it had always been understood to lead to, dwelling in the realm of the Creator God. The Buddha kept that name. He kept the frame. And in at least one famous discourse, he used it explicitly. The discourse is the Tevija Sutta, Daya Nikaya 13. Two Brahmins come to the Buddha and ask him the path to union with Brahma, to fellowship with the Creator God, the goal of their entire spiritual tradition. The Buddha, in that discourse, plays the role of expert on the Vedic question. His answer is striking. Cultivate the four Brahmaviharas. Practice universal friendliness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. That is the path to union with God. That is what your tradition has been pointing at all along. The Buddhist Metta-Nisamsa Sutta, which lists the 11 benefits of cultivating loving-kindness, ends with this line, "If you penetrate no higher, you will be reborn in a Brahma realm." Across 2,500 years of Buddhist commentary, that line has never been removed. Even in the most rigorously non-theistic Theravada framing, the cultivation of metta is officially understood to lead at minimum to rebirth in the divine realm of the Creator God. The Buddha did add something new to the older practice. He suggested that a further liberation was possible beyond rebirth in Brahmaloka. But even in his own teaching, the original goal remained intact. Metta was, and is, the path to dwelling in the realm of the Creator. He never pretended otherwise. The earliest Buddhist layer. When the Buddha's teachings were eventually committed to writing, first in oral memorization by his immediate disciples, then in written canonical form in Sri Lanka several centuries later, the earliest stratum gave the Brahmaviharas a central place. The Karaniya Metta Sutta that this book builds on lives in the Sutta Nipata, which the Pali prosody scholar A.K. Warder identified as belonging to the earliest phase of extant Buddhist literature. The Kagavisa Sutta, the Rhinoceros Sutta, one of the very oldest Buddhist texts surviving even in early Gandharan manuscripts unearthed in modern Pakistan, likewise centers the four immeasurables as the path. The earliest layer of Buddhist material, in other words, is essentially a metta literature. The elaborate doctrinal architecture of later Buddhism, the Abhidhamma classifications, the Eightfold Path enumerations, the sectarian distinctions, came later. The original instruction was simpler: cultivate friendliness toward all beings, cultivate compassion toward those who suffer, rejoice in others' good fortune, remain steady in the face of what you cannot change. That was the practice. It was already old when the Buddha taught it. In the centuries since, the Mahayana traditions added bodhicitta, the mind of awakening, essentially metta scaled to a cosmic project. Tibetan Buddhism added tunglen, the practice of breathing in others' suffering and breathing out one's own well-being. Zen, Pure Land, and the other East Asian schools each added their own emphases. The Dalai Lama's repeated insistence that kindness is my religion is, in essence, a contemporary restatement of the entire metta tradition. The same teaching in Christianity. A reader formed by the Christian tradition will recognize this immediately, if they have not already. The central commandment of Christianity, given by Jesus, is love your neighbor as yourself, Matthew 22 verse 39, in the context of also loving God with the whole of one's being. The Sermon on the Mount goes further still: love your enemies, bless those who curse you, Matthew 5 verse 44, a teaching almost identical in substance to the most demanding part of the Karaniya Metta Sutta. The first letter of John is more direct still. God is love, and whoever lives in love lives in God, and God in them. 1 John 4 verse 16. This is the same instruction as the Karaniya Metta Sutta. It is the same instruction as the Chandogya Upanishad. The vocabulary is different. The metaphysics is described in different categories. But the practice is the same: cultivate universal love, and you will dwell in the divine. The Greek word that the Christian scriptures use for this kind of love is agape, universal, unconditional, divine love, distinct from the more limited Greek words for romantic, familial, or friendly affection. Agape is structurally identical to metta in its perfected form. Jesus' famous saying about the kingdom of heaven, in Luke 17 verse 21, "The kingdom of God is within you," has the same structure as the Brahmaloka teaching. The divine realm is not, fundamentally, in a far-off place. It is realized inside the practitioner who cultivates the love that God is. The kingdom of heaven is within because love is within because the divine, in this teaching, is love. The Christian contemplative tradition, from the Desert Fathers through Meister Eckhart through the modern centering prayer movement of Thomas Keating and others, has been pointing at this same realization for 2,000 years, sometimes in nearly the same words as their Indian counterparts, often without knowing it. The Dolly Parton epigraph at the front of this book is a folk American articulation of the same thing. The kingdom of heaven is inside. It is right inside of you. There is nothing in this teaching that requires reading any Sanskrit or any Pali. It can be said in three sentences in any language. The same teaching in Judaism. The Hebrew Bible commands the same thing. Leviticus 19 verse 18. Love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord. The placement of those last four words is not incidental. The reason to love your neighbor is that the divine is. To love is to participate in the way the divine acts. The Jewish term that maps most cleanly onto metta is chaste, usually translated as loving kindness, and sometimes as steadfast love or covenantal love. In the Hebrew Bible, chaste is one of the central attributes of God. In the later Jewish mystical tradition, particularly in Kabbalah, chaste is one of the sephiro, the divine emanations through which God sustains creation. To practice chaste, in this view, is to participate in the same activity by which the world itself is held together. It is, structurally, the same understanding the Chandogya Upanishad gave 1,000 years earlier. The cosmos is sustained by friendly love, and to live in friendly love is to live in alignment with the source of being. The great Rabbi Hillel, when asked to summarize the entire Torah while standing on one foot, said, "That which is hateful to you, do not do to your neighbor. The rest is commentary. Go and learn." This is metta said in negative form, by a Jewish teacher, a generation before Jesus. And in Islam, the Prophet Muhammad said, "None of you truly believes until he loves for his brother what he loves for himself." Sari al-Bukhari, Hadith 13. Two of the divine names in Islam, Aram and Aram, both translate roughly as the compassionate. The Sufi mystical tradition, in particular, produced perhaps the most luminous poetic literature of universal love in any tradition, Rumi, Hafiz, Ibn Arabi. They were not inventing a new teaching. They were singing the same one. Indigenous and folk traditions. Many indigenous traditions worldwide articulate forms of universal kindness as a basic ethical orientation, often extended explicitly to non-human beings, ancestors, and land. The Lakota phrase Mitakuya Oyazaying, all my relations, is essentially metta said in a single phrase, the recognition that every being is kin, and is to be treated as such. Similar formulations appear in Maori, Andean, West African, and many other indigenous frameworks. The practice does not belong to any one tradition because it has been independently discovered nearly everywhere. One realization, many languages. What all of these traditions are pointing at is, in the end, a single realization. They describe it in incompatible metaphysical vocabularies. They reach it from different cultural starting points. They institutionalized it differently. They sometimes fought about it. But the realization itself is consistent. Universal love is what the divine consists of. Dwelling in universal love is, in some real sense, dwelling in the divine. Vedic Hinduism calls the destination Brahmaloka. Buddhism calls it the Brahmavihara. Judaism calls it living in chaste. Christianity calls it the kingdom of heaven within, or abiding in agape, or simply living in God. Sufism calls it union with the beloved. The Lakota tradition gestures toward it with Mitakuya Oyazaying. The vocabulary varies. The instruction does not. This is why the practice in this book has the unusual property of being recognizable across nearly every contemplative tradition the species has produced. It belongs to no one in particular, not to Buddhism, not to Hinduism, not to Christianity or Judaism or Islam or any indigenous tradition. It is something more like a discovery, the way fire is a discovery, or fermentation, or arithmetic. Many cultures arrived at it independently, because it is genuinely there to be found. A word on belief. A reader without religious commitments may worry that this chapter is asking them to take on a metaphysics. It is not. The practice does not require theism. The science cited in Chapter 4, by researchers who in many cases hold no religious view at all, confirms that the mechanism works on its own terms. But it is worth being honest about the lineage. The practice came down to us, originally, as a way to dwell in the realm of the Creator. That framing is not a quaint old wrapping that the modern reader needs to discard. It is, in some real sense, what the original practitioners were doing. The Christian saint and the Vedic seer and the Buddhist monk and the Sufi mystic, when they sat down to cultivate universal love, all believed they were participating in something larger than a self-improvement technique, and the strength of their practice came partly from that belief. If you do not have a religious framework, the practice is also yours. You are training a real capacity in a real nervous system, and the benefits arrive whether you believe in their cosmological backdrop or not. The earliest Vedic practitioners believed the practice tuned them to the friendly God who held the cosmos together. The modern secular practitioner can frame the same exercise as tuning the nervous system to its most prosocial and resilient configuration. Both readings are honest. Both readings produce the same human being on the other side. Whatever turns up the volume. Here is a suggestion that may run against your instincts, particularly if you've inherited a strong identity as either secular or religious. Do not pick a framing, secular or theistic, and stick with it forever as a matter of self-image. Try both. Often. The reason is practical. Some sessions, the secular framing, I am training a real nervous system capacity for warm affiliative response, produces a strong, clean, durable felt sense of warmth. Other sessions, the theistic framing, I am dwelling for a moment in the love that is God, this is a gape passing through me, this is what the older traditions called Brahmaloka, and I am tasting it from the inside, produces something noticeably more intense, more overwhelming, more transformative. For a lot of practitioners, the religious framing turns the volume up in a way the secular framing alone does not. For others, the reverse. For most, it depends on the day. This is partly cultural and partly idiosyncratic. If you grew up hearing God is love, that phrase has machinery behind it that the human nervous system can ride into something extraordinary. If you didn't grow up that way, the same words may feel hollow, and a frame about the universe of social mammals, the trainable capacity for affiliative warmth, may unlock just as much. The right answer is to use whichever vocabulary, today, gets you to the highest volume of love you can sustain. Switch freely. Don't be precious about it. I have done long stretches with each. Months of strictly secular framing produced steady, durable, real benefits. Months of explicit theistic framing, I am loving these beings with the love that is God, the love by which the cosmos is held together, produced more intense, more overwhelming sits and a noticeably brighter daily baseline. Both did real work. Pretending one is the right way leaves intensity on the table. The test is the volume the framing produces, not the metaphysics it implies. The instruction merges with Chapter 5's, turn it up. Use whatever framework, on a given morning, in a given mood, lets you turn it up the highest. That's the whole rule. Adapting the practice to your tradition. If you have a religious framework, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, indigenous, or otherwise, this practice is, with very minor adjustment, the practice your own tradition has been carrying for as long as it has existed. Use whatever vocabulary is most alive for you. Some examples. Christians can take Jesus, the Virgin Mary, the Holy Spirit, or any saint as an anchor, and frame the practice as participation in a gape, God's own love flowing through the practitioner to every being it touches. Useful phrasings. May they be at peace, by the grace of God. May I love them with the love that flows through Christ. May the kingdom of heaven be within me, and through me, in everyone I meet. The Sermon on the Mount and 1 John 4 are direct scriptural anchors. Jews can use the recollection of chaste as a central frame and ground the practice in Leviticus 19, Hillel's one-foot Torah, and the rich liturgical and psalmic tradition of God's loving-kindness. Useful phrasings. May I dwell in chaste. May I extend chaste. May this be a small participation in the love that sustains creation. Muslims can use the recollection of God's mercy Aram as the anchor, and frame the practice as conformity with the divine compassion the Quran opens with. Useful phrasings. May God grant them ease. May God protect them. May God guide them to peace. Bismillahi Aramni Aram. The Sufi poets Rumi, Hafiz, Ibn Arabi are companion literature. Hindus can use Krishna, Shiva, the Divine Mother, or any chosen form of the divine as the anchor, treating the practice as a recognition that all beings are manifestations of the same divine reality. The Bhagavad Gita, chapter 12, and the Upanishadic Tat Tvam Aci You Are That are foundational. Patanjali's Yoga Sutra 1.33 is essentially this practice in its classical form. Buddhists of every school will find the practice in their own canon. Theravadins have the Karaniya Metta Sutta and Buddhaghosa's Visuddhimagga. Mahayanists have the Bodhisitta literature. Tibetans have Tunglen and the Lojong mind training. Zen practitioners have the Bodhisattva vow. The practice is the same, the supporting context differs. Indigenous practitioners can use whatever language for kinship and relatedness is alive in their tradition, all my relations, the recognition that every being is family. Practitioners with no religious framework can simply do the practice, framed naturalistically. Humans are social mammals, the capacity for warm affiliative response is real, trainable, and well documented, training it produces measurable benefits. That is enough. The instruction does not require the metaphysics. But the metaphysics, if you have one, is welcome. The substance is the same in every case. Whatever vocabulary helps you generate the feeling and return to it across the day is the right vocabulary for you. A word on simplicity. A view worth considering, for those of us who are householders rather than monastics, the earliest forms of this practice, Chandogya 8.15, the Maitreya Upanishad, Patanjali 1.33, the Suttanapata, the Sermon on the Mount, Hillel's one-foot Torah may be, for ordinary purposes, the best forms of it. They are simpler. They are less encrusted with sectarian commentary. They give an instruction that fits in a sentence and can be lived without belonging to any particular institution. Cultivate boundless friendliness toward all beings, all the time, the mind will clarify, and the divine realm will follow. The later traditions added enormous depth. Some of that depth is genuinely useful. Some of it is the product of monastic specialists writing for other monastic specialists across many centuries, and it is not always clear that the elaborations made the practice better for ordinary people. For most readers of this book, the most authentic form of the practice is also the oldest one, the simple instruction, repeated faithfully, for the rest of your life. That is what the Karaniya Metta Sutta says. That is what the Metta-Nisamsa Sutta promises. That is what the Chandogya Upanishad taught 1,000 years before the Buddha. That is what Jesus taught when he said the kingdom of heaven was within you. The instruction has not changed because it has not needed to. What matters is not which version of the lineage you trace your practice through. What matters is that you have the lineage at all. 3,000 years of human beings have already done the experiment, in many languages, under many sky gods, in many monasteries and synagogues and churches and forest huts. The result is in. You are not trying something new. You are picking up a thread that has been kept warm by countless hands before yours, and adding your own steady contribution to it.